From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, are we headed for World War III? Stand by for that. And, of course, stand by for what we have in store for you tonight in just a moment. Tainted celery, that's the culprit in a recent E. coli outbreak. The source of an E. coli outbreak spanning seven states has now been traced back to a single ingredient in Costco's rotisserie chicken salad, diced celery. The tainted ingredient came from Taylor Farms Pacific of Tracy, California. Now the supplier has since issued a recall for the items that may contain its celery. The recall affects nearly a dozen retailers, including 7-Eleven, Safeway, Walmart, Sam's Club, Target, and Starbucks. With encouragement from 150 world leaders ringing in their ears, government negotiators in Paris were through Tuesday left to turn the rhetoric into reality and agree on a draft text of a global deal to slow climate change, they say. President Barack Obama and the Chinese president made common cause, and other countries stressed the urgency of an agreement to slow what they say a rise in global temperatures blamed for spurring floods, heat waves, and rising sea levels. The fast radio burst included one double signal never heard before and have left astronomers buzzing with excitement over the possibility of it being a message with alien origins. Only 11 of the unidentified radio pulses have been recorded before around the world. This one picked up in Australia. Let's check in with Dr. Sky. I think it might be natural, Stephen, but what do you think?
Some of the theories go on this particular episode that we're talking about is that even the radio astronomers have once determined that it was actually spurious radiation coming off, no doubt, their microwave ovens. But on a more serious note, here's what astronomers think, at least right now. A new term, maybe to the Coast audience, is an object in astronomy called a blitzar. I didn't say Blitzen, one of Santa's reindeer, but a blitzar, George, simply is a neutron star, this compact material that's a remnant of a supernova that spins so fast that it's going, the centrifugal force is forcing it to go so fast that eventually, when it slows down, it blasts off as it collapses into a black hole. And astronomers and physicists think, astrophysicists, that this might be the reason or the source mechanism behind these fast radio bursts. And what's interesting is the one burst itself has the energy that the sun produces in, get a load of this, 300,000 years.
Jeez.
But what makes it unusual is many people believe, and I certainly am open-minded about this, of course, like we are on this show, that if it has extraterrestrial origin behind it, the most famous one was Jerry Ehrman's August 15, 1977, signal that he picked up from a radio telescope, 72 seconds long, never repeated. So we really don't know, but that's probably from the astronomy world what it might be. But, George, closer to home, as we get closer to next, I can't believe it's December already.
No, we're rolling along.
It's amazing. As we get closer to the 7th, the morning of the 7th, all of our Coast listeners should pay attention to the moon and Venus, because during the period just after sunset, for much of the listening audience, the moon will occult or cover up Venus, a very rare event. And it's also a time, sandwiched kind of in that area, very close in a pair of binoculars, is this comet Catalina. So much to talk about, and we're welcoming everybody to check us out at drsky.com. George, it's always fun to talk about these cool things. We got a lot of things coming.
All right. Thanks, Stephen. Dr. Sky. At least 300 Americans, many of them women, are acting as ISIS ambassadors on social media, spreading propaganda, hunting for potential recruits, according to a new report. Now, the researchers at George Washington University's program on extremism said that Twitter is the platform of choice for the U.S.-based sympathizers, even though the service regularly suspends accounts that spew the ISIS material. The Federal Bureau of Investigation has used a secretive authority to compel internet and telecommunication firms to hand over customer data, including an individual's complete web browsing history and records of all online purchases. Can you believe that? The documents are believed to be the first time the government has provided details of its so-called national security letters, which are used by the FBI to conduct electronic surveillance without the need for court approval. The expert on the Internet, Lauren Weinstein, with us. Lauren, how do they get away with this?
Yeah, well NSLs, national security letters, have actually been around for quite a while, and by their very nature, they weren't talked about much at first. Apparently, there have been around 300,000 of them issued in the last 10 years. 56,000 in 2004, still today, maybe 60 every day. And they almost always include a gag order. So these orders will go to an ISP, sometimes a very small ISP or other organization that's dealing with Internet-type materials, and will order them to turn over the metadata, essentially, the record data, contact information, web browsing history, not the content of communications, usually. And that has to be turned over immediately. You can talk to a lawyer about it, but you can't talk to anyone else, and normally you can't even tell anyone that you got a national security letter. So some of these have been challenged in court, and there's it's very interesting right now. One small ISP that's been battling this for ages actually managed to get a court to say, hey, you could talk about this a little bit more than anyone normally hears. It still doesn't have the real nitty-gritty details, but basically what this is a shortcut mechanism for the government to get metadata information without actually going through all the processes of a court order. And most observers feel that, well, you know, there can be situations where that kind of information is important to an intelligence investigation, but it's clearly been overused, and the gag order that's built in seems to be constitutionally suspect, you know, no matter how you look at it.
All right, Lauren, thank you. And get this, the personal information of about 5 million people, including the photos and profiles of more than 200,000 children, has been exposed following a hack of the electronic toy maker VTech. This is just happening way too much. And up next, a subject very dear to my heart, of course, what happens when our power grids go out? And of course, we've talked about, of course, electromagnetic pulses, somebody detonating a nuke in the atmosphere that would knock out the power grids, and also an X-flare from the sun, a big one. But what about hacking? Up next, Lights Out. Ted Koppel joins us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Ted Koppel, a 42-year veteran of ABC News, was the anchor and managing editor of the incredible program Nightline from 1980 to 2005. In 2012, New York University named him one of the top 100 American journalists of the past 100 years. And since that time, he has served as managing editor of the Discovery Channel, as a news analyst for the BBC in America here, and as a special correspondent for the Rock Center, and continues to function as a commentator and nonfiction book critic at NPR. He has been a contributing columnist to the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal. And tonight we are going to talk with you for a couple hours with Ted about a subject that is so dear to all of us and probably one of the most important stories I have ever talked about on this program. Ted, welcome to Coast to Coast. So great to have you.
Thank you, George.
I've got to, first of all, thank you on behalf of the millions of people listening to you right now for the service that you have provided to us over all these years. And you haven't stopped, especially with this book, Lights Out. But I was a news director back in 1980 at an NBC station when you started Nightline. And after our 10 o'clock newscast ended at 10:30 Central Time, I couldn't wait to watch you. And just thanks on behalf of everybody for what you've done.
That's probably why you got fired from the station, George. It seems to have worked out all right for you.
Ted, this story that you have written, I want to talk a little bit about your career, which got you into all of this, but Lights Out. Tell me how you got to talking about this, how you got to writing about it, because it's a critical story.
Well, as you're suggesting, George, this is not anything new. And not only is it nothing new, it's nothing that the administration, this administration or even previous administrations, have been keeping particularly quiet. Quite the contrary. President Obama has twice made reference to the danger of cyber attacks on infrastructure with particular emphasis on the power grid. The former Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, spoke about the danger of a cyber Pearl Harbor. I interviewed the current commander of CENTCOM, General Lloyd Austin. He said it's not a question of if, it's only a question of when there is a cyber attack on the power grid. So I'd been reading some of these comments and hearing some of these comments, and my question really was, how come nobody's paying any attention to this? Why was it not getting the kind of coverage that I thought it ought to get? And furthermore, I wondered if indeed senior people, senior members of the administration are convinced that this is going to happen. I wonder what it is that the federal government is doing to prepare for the eventuality, because the likelihood of this happening is great. The impact of it is going to be extraordinary. We're talking here about the possibility of a power grid, and as you probably know, George, we have three power grids in this country. The Eastern Interconnect, which is the one that I'm in, goes all the way from the East Coast west past Chicago. So you're talking about the potential here of tens of millions of people being without electricity for a period of months.
Some of the predictions, if the power goes out even longer than that, could be 90% of the American people would die within the first year because of lack of services. You can't get water. You can't get fuel. You can't go out and get food. It would be a disaster, Ted, as you know, of biblical proportions. We've talked on this program a lot about the EMP attack from a nation that might detonate a nuke over our country, or a solar flare from the sun, which would be big enough to knock out the grid. It happened during the Carrington event in the 1800s. We had the telegraph system that got knocked out. We haven't talked a lot about what you are talking about and writing about now, which is just as critical. Lights out, of course, about cyber attacks. Now, we can insulate the grid against an EMP attack and against a solar flare if they go ahead and do it. I don't know why they haven't attempted that yet either. But what about a cyber attack? Can that be stopped?
No.
Oh, boy.
I mean, and let me just make one point, George, because I know you're interested in the accuracy of what you say. What you referred to, the danger of as many as 90% of the American public dying in the aftermath of an event like this, is a specific reference to the danger of an EMP attack. That is not a number that is normally associated with what I'm talking about.
Correct.
Which is a cyber attack on the grid. That would be bad enough. But I haven't seen, when you cite that figure, it actually comes from the EMP commission that was created by Congress. I think it was initially back in 2004. And that commission lasted until 2008. And their conclusion, and it was a very high-powered commission, their conclusion was, in the event that you had an EMP attack on the United States, that there was a possibility that as many as 90% of the American public would die. I think the likelihood of I know there are many people, including the former director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey, who believes that an EMP attack is not that unlikely. I happen to believe it's far less likely than what I'm talking about in Lights Out.
I think you're right. I think the possibility of a cyber attack or a dabbling of a cyber attack are very, very possible. What about the prime suspects if something like this happens? I mean, you look at Russia, you look at China. I don't think, Ted, they're dumb enough to try to do that to us, because we probably have the capability of doing the same thing.
It's not probably, George. I think you can rest assured, and so can your audience. The United States is still the most competent nation in the world when it comes to cyber offense. The danger here is that we've never paid as much attention to cyber defense. And even beyond that, even if we had been paying more attention to it, the problem with the Internet is it was never designed to be defended in the first place. When the Internet was created, nobody ever envisioned hackers. Nobody ever envisioned that there could be or would be attacks on the Internet. So it was never designed for a defense system to be imposed upon it. That's the great danger. But to get back to your question for a moment, you're absolutely right. The nations that have the greatest capability of launching a cyber attack, that are in fact believed by our intelligence agencies to be inside our grid already, are the Chinese and the Russians. We have so many interlocking interests with the Chinese and the Russians that I think what you say is absolutely correct. The likelihood of them launching an attack against us is relatively low, at least at this point. But as you go down the level of capability, the Iranians, who are probably the third most capable in the world, the North Koreans, the Syrians, a group like ISIS, for example.
Uh-huh.
As you go down the line in terms of capability, you go up the line in terms of the likelihood of an attack. I don't think there's any question in anybody's mind that if ISIS got the capability of being able to launch a cyber attack, there is absolutely nothing that would prevent them from doing it. Not the morality of it, not the danger of a reciprocal attack, because as you and most of your listeners, I'm sure, already know, the problem with cyber attacks is you don't immediately know where they came from. Think only about the North Korean attack on Sony, Sony Pictures. I don't think there was anyone who doubted when they heard that Sony Pictures had been hacked, knowing that that goofy movie about the North Korean dictator
mm-hmm.
had just been or was about to be released by Sony. I don't think anyone had any doubt as to who launched that attack. Even so, it took the FBI months before they were able to establish beyond any doubt that the North Koreans had done it. So the great danger is, those who are most capable, least likely to do it. Those who are less capable, more likely to do it.
If the grid is hit by some kind of cyber attack, how long would it last? I mean, could they, and you talked about weeks or months, but I mean, could they not just quickly say, oh my gosh, we just got hacked, we went into our system and fixed it, and it's back up again, it's down for a couple hours?
The problem is, once somebody gets inside the system, and I think we need to make it absolutely clear, what we're talking about here is incredibly complex. It's not easy to do. It takes years to map the Internet system that actually controls the grid. And the one thing we've got on this program is time, so if you don't mind, let me just spend a wonky moment or two explaining what it is about the grid that makes it so vulnerable to a cyber attack.
Couple minutes to the break, Ted. Go ahead.
All right. Imagine for a moment a giant balloon that has 1,000 valves. If 500 of those valves are introducing air into the balloon and the other 500 taking it out, as long as you keep an absolute balance between the air coming in and the air going out, the balloon remains perfectly inflated. Too much air in, the balloon bursts. Too much air out, the balloon collapses. So too with the electric power grid. You have to have a perfect balance maintained between the amount of electricity that is generated and the amount of electricity that is used. The problem is you've got 3,200 different electric companies in this country. Maintaining that kind of a perfect balance among that many companies requires the Internet. So if you can get into these so-called SCADA systems, supervisory control and data acquisition, you can keep screwing around with it. If someone is in, it's not a question of sort of setting off a bomb and then stepping back to see what happens. It's a matter of constantly playing with the system so that you can keep it down. That's the danger.
During World War II, we knew who our enemy was. As a matter of fact, you could see your enemy because he wore a uniform. Nowadays, Ted, that's gone. And I would guess the same is with those who hack into websites and other systems. These are people in obscure places sitting with computers and systems. It may take, as you said, a long, long time to figure out where they're coming from.
It's a terrific point, George, and if you're coming right out to a break, we should probably focus on that when you come back.
You got that right. Gosh, I love this. A man who understands broadcasting. Ted Koppel with us. His book is called Lights Out. His website, linked up at coasttocoastam.com, tedkoppellightsout.com. Go ahead and go to our website and look at the trailer, the little video clip of him, and this will explain a lot. We'll be back. Our special guest tonight, Ted Koppel. As we talk about his work, Lights Out. We'll take phone calls with Ted next hour, but there's so much more to talk with him about, so we shall do that. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Ted Koppel with us as we talk about his work, Lights Out, and just an incredible story, a real story about the possibility of a cyber attack that could knock out our nation's grid systems and put us back to the dark ages. Ted, we were talking before the break about where are these people? How do you find them? I mean, are they in like some small closet with a couple computers? How sophisticated does this have to be?
It's pretty sophisticated, but let's just go back a few years in time to the last great threat, which continues to be a threat, you know, the danger of a nuclear attack against the United States. At least the President of the United States would have had two things. Number one, let's say those Soviet missiles had been launched back in the 1960s or 70s. The President would have had about 28 minutes, and he would have had advance notice the missiles are coming, and there would have been absolutely no doubt in his mind where they were coming from. He could have then reached the decision that he was going to wait for the missiles to impact to know precisely what kind of a counterstrike to launch, or he could have launched the counterstrike immediately. Not so with a cyber attack. As we were discussing before the break, George, the danger with a cyber attack is it's very, very difficult to track immediately. We've all been through this kind of scenario where someone is sitting there and the attack appears to be coming from Ukraine, let's say. And then as the intelligence people begin to track it back further and further, no, didn't originate in the Ukraine. It appears to have originated in Bogota, Colombia. Mm-hmm. No, it wasn't Bogota. It was Melbourne, Australia. No, not Melbourne, Paris, France. Wait a second. The last indicator that we have is it didn't originate in Paris. It originated in Queens, New York. Now what do you do?
Yeah, exactly. Prior to the Internet, when we had electricity, of course, how did the systems work for the grid?
Well, you're absolutely right in asking the question, and it's exactly the right question to ask. Prior to the Internet, the industry as a whole was what's called vertically integrated. In other words, you would have one company that would generate the power, it would transmit the power across vast distances, and it would then deliver the power to the local customer. These days, there is more of a breakup. With the deregulation of the industry, what happened is that now, as I suggested to you before, there are 3,200 different companies. There are still some huge companies out there that have done an enormous amount in terms of trying to impose a system of cybersecurity on what they've got. But those companies are connected to the smaller ones. The smaller ones have neither the money nor the inclination to worry about security. And as with any network, if you can get into one part of the network, you can eventually track your way back to the other parts. But your question is exactly the right question. Before we had the Internet, all of these companies operated on an analog system. So they were, curiously, far less vulnerable mm-hmm. to the kind of attack that you and I are talking about right now. It's, you know, I draw the analogy in my book, and Lights Out, to what happened with automobiles. If people had known 120 years ago or 110 years ago that the day would come that we would be losing as we were in the 1970s, for example, close to 50,000 people a year. Would they have gone ahead? Pardon me. Would they have gone ahead with the development of the car?
Good question.
Hard to say. But once the car becomes a part of the fabric of our daily lives, as it is now, if you put it up to a national plebiscite and you said, hey, folks, we're still losing 25,000 to 30,000 people a year, losing deaths. I mean, we haven't, in both the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, we haven't lost close to 30,000 Americans, right, over all the years that we have been fighting. And yet we accept that as a necessary cost of having the automobile, having trucks, having motorcycles, buses. It's the same thing with the Internet. We have reached a point now where the Internet is so thoroughly integrated into everything we do. We have become so accustomed to the benefits of the Internet that the likelihood that we're ever going to go back to the old analog system of the electric power system is slim and none.
Did we get too technologically advanced?
Yes, I suppose that's one way of putting it. We did, because with all of the assets, and there is no question that the Internet provides us with quite literally millions of advantages, but they come with an inherent danger, and the danger is the vulnerability that I spoke about earlier on in the program. You can't defend the Internet 100%.
Absolutely. You know, we love this country. You love this country. You were born in the United Kingdom. You're a U.S. citizen now. I was born in Detroit. We would do anything we can to protect this country. And it just saddens me, Ted, as a broadcaster. And now that you have the ability to step out of the unbiasedness of a broadcaster and just say it the way you feel, I just don't get how they're not trying to fix things or protect us. I mean, we're spending billions of dollars in weaponry to try to defend us. Why can't we do this?
As I said, it's next to impossible, and I'm not speaking now out of any expertise of my own. I've been doing in pulling this book together what I always used to do before, and that is go to the smartest people I could find, the best experts I could find, and what I'm reflecting here are the views of those people. And what I'm expressing here, George, is not a matter of opinion. Even though I'm not so directly involved in broadcasting as I was before, I'm afraid the habits of a lifetime of more than 50 years as a reporter die hard. I'm not expressing a personal point of view. I am reflecting the opinions of the best intelligence people I could talk to, the best military people I could talk to, people within the electric power industry itself, although I must confess there weren't many of those who were willing to talk to me about it. But, you know, the reality is, it's a vulnerable industry, terribly vulnerable. The question I have, George, and I hope we have a chance to talk about this too, is not just the question of defending the power grid. As I say, I think that may be beyond our capability. But what we are going to do in the aftermath of an attack like this, what preparations, if any, has the government made to deal with the aftermath of an attack like this? And we can get into that if and when you
sure. We saw the disaster with Hurricane Katrina, where FEMA dropped the ball. They couldn't handle it. This would be 100 times worse, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. Let me just tell you, and this is not anything new, George. In 2010, a group of 10 former senior officials, when I say senior officials, I mean there were two former directors of the CIA, two former secretaries of defense, two former national security advisors to the president, and four other experts who sent a classified letter to a congressional committee. The congressional committee was considering cybersecurity legislation. And in that letter, they warned that an attack like this, and they had spoken to the best people in government they could find, that an attack like this was all but inevitable, and that the impact of it could include tens of millions of people, and that the aftermath could last as long as years.
And if it does, we are literally up the creek. Now, the book came out a little more than a month ago, and my producers tell me already it's ranked 137th on Amazon and climbing like crazy. So hopefully after this program, Ted, enough people will start realizing what's going on here. And I want to also offer you the opportunity anytime you need to get the word out about what you're doing on this subject, you're invited on anytime you want.
That's very kind of you, George. Actually, the good news is it's been slipping for the last few days. So it was up as high as, I think, number 15 or 16 on Amazon. It's been on the New York Times bestseller list for the past 3 weeks and will be again next Sunday.
It sure will be. Well, it'll keep pushing. Now, the aftermath, which is probably more important than the actual disaster when it occurs, let's just use New York as an example. The power goes out. No ATMs, no running water, because some people don't realize that there are electric pumps that push the water into your house. It just doesn't come out of the tap. All these services will stop. Now, you might be able to prepare, as we've talked about, food and water and things like that for a little while, but what happens if this lasts 6 months? Then what?
Exactly. Now, people in rural sectors of the United States are not only likely to be better protected, they are better protected. First of all, people who live out in the countryside have more of a tendency to keep a large freezer stocked with food, and to have an emergency generator, and to have a sufficient amount of fuel to keep that generator going for a while. People in the cities, as you point out, are really going to be in trouble, because when you talk about an inability to get running water, you're not just talking about drinking water. FEMA and the government will be able to bring in supplies of drinking water. Although, again, if we're talking about tens of millions of people, well, what do you think the supply is? The great danger, and it's going to be a danger in a matter of days. No running water means you can't flush the toilet. In a city like New York, where you have 8 million people in the five boroughs, the inability to get rid of human waste in a matter of 2 to 3 days is going to cause an enormous health crisis.
Oh, my God.
So that's going to be one of the very first problems that the government has to deal with. But multiply that by 10 cities, 15 cities, 20 cities, and the capacity of the government to respond, which, as you correctly point out, after Hurricane Katrina, was shown to be limited. I must tell you, the man, Craig Fugate, the administrator of FEMA today, is a far, far better professional than what was his name, Brownie, right?
What we had, that's right.
Yeah. Nice, good job, Brownie. That was the famous quote from President Bush.
Good job.
Craig Fugate is terrific at this, but he is the first to acknowledge that this is a problem beyond the capacity of the government, as things are currently constituted, to handle.
Yeah, a small region, maybe you can take care of that. Anything bigger than that, it's a disaster. Last year, Ted, I do broadcasting this program in St. Louis or Los Angeles, and I go back and forth. Last year, of course, very close to Ferguson, Missouri, where we had that sad situation with the police officer killing the youth. And the after effects of that, beyond the protesting, which, as far as I'm concerned, people have a right to do that. They have a right to protest. But there were others, outside influences, that broke store windows and burned cars and stole things. The same thing will happen with this. The looters and those who think they have to survive and steal are going to go crazy, aren't they?
And the only body that's really going to be capable of dealing with it on a scale such as the one we've been discussing, George, is the U.S. military.
Yes. Yes. Almost unheard of to think of that possibility, but that it's going to happen. Now let's talk, if we can, Ted, about, and this is speculation, odds of the possibility of a cyber attack on our power systems, our grids.
Well, I spend one of the chapters in Lights Out talking to the best insurance specialists I can find. I figured if anybody knows what the odds are, and if anybody has made an effort to calculate the odds of the likelihood of a cyber attack, it would be the people in the insurance industry. So I called my old friend Warren Buffett at Berkshire Hathaway and said, you own one of the biggest insurance companies in the country. And he, in turn, put me in touch with a man by the name of Ajit Jain. Ajit Jain handles the reinsurance business. Now, as you probably know, George, reinsurance deals with insurance companies coming to another company, in this case Berkshire Hathaway, and saying, the risk is so great of A, B, or C happening, we want to cover our rear ends a little bit by reinsuring ourselves with you. So I spent the better part of an hour talking to Ajit Jain and a couple of other specialists that he brought onto our phone call with us. And the bottom line was the possibility of this happening. I mean, believe me, if the insurance industry thought that this was unlikely, they'd be willing to issue all the insurance policies that anyone is dumb enough to buy, right?
Yeah.
But they are so concerned about the likelihood of this happening and so unable to calculate what the odds would be and what the ultimate cost would be that Berkshire Hathaway, for example, as Ajit Jain told me, might be willing to put up a couple of $1 billion. That sounds like a lot of money until you think, he told me that if a Force 5 hurricane were to hit Miami, that the expected hit on the insurance industry would be, I forget the exact number, I think it was somewhere in the neighborhood of $25 billion. And he gave what I later called the $25 billion shrug. And it was, well, you know, it would be a tough hit, but we could handle it.
Wow.
What they're talking about in terms of the consequences of a cyber attack on the power industry is so great they can't even calculate it and are therefore unwilling to provide more than maybe $1 billion worth of insurance.
Oh,
and in terms of, you know, the large insurance companies, that's peanuts.
Ted, if you were back doing Nightline, how often would you be pounding away at this subject?
Boy, I don't know. It's an interesting question. If I must tell you, I think it requires what you're giving it right now, which is a national conversation. I think it requires, we are, after all, just at the beginning. It feels like the middle, but we're just at the beginning of a presidential campaign. I really would like to see the candidates pick up the issue and discuss it. This should not be a partisan issue, George.
No.
This shouldn't be something that divides conservatives and liberals or Republicans and Democrats. It's an issue of national concern and how we deal with the consequences of an attack like this. What it is that the federal government can do, what it is that individuals can do, what it is that communities should do. These are things we need to be talking about. I offer a couple of modest proposals in the book. I don't pretend to have the answers, but that's the kind of thing that comes out of a vibrant democracy when people confront what is a real looming danger.
We're coming back with a final hour with Ted Koppel. We're going to take phone calls. And folks, if you know the name Walter Cronkite, or the name David Brinkley, or John Chancellor, Frank Reynolds, throw in the name Ted Koppel, because he's in that class. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.